You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon again for those who were here a few minutes ago in our other event. I'm Brahima Koulibaly, a senior fellow in global economy and development and the director of the Africa program. We know it's a busy time in Washington, and there's certainly no shortage of events. So we appreciate you joining us in this late afternoon to discuss the future of work in Africa. I think once the event went out, it was basically booked very, very quickly, within like 2 days. And for a moment that I thought maybe I was very popular, but it looks more likely it's because of the importance of the topic, and it speaks volume to how critical and central this issue is for Africa. So let me mention that this is being organized jointly between Brookings and the World Bank, represented here by Jean-Claude Chatuan, who is executive director for over 20 countries at the bank. So he has his work cut out for him. And by Albert Zoufak, the chief economist for the Africa region. And the conversation is motivated around a recent report that they released entitled The Future of Work in Africa, Harnessing the Potential of Digital Technologies for All. And this was authored by Zainab Usman, Mark Dutz, and June Choi, the authors. They're all here. You'll hear from them shortly. So to put today's event in context, the advent of the fourth industrial revolution, which has been characterized by rapid digitization, growing utilization of new technologies, has really ushered in a new era of economic disruption and ignited a global debate, right, on the implication for labor markets or the future of work. For those who are more concerned about the implication for labor market, they argue that the current rate of adoption of labor-saving technologies will cause massive job loss. Some estimates put it at about in half of the global jobs currently out there. So what that means is if this side of this room is half, the other is half, those on this side might lose their jobs, or maybe you prefer to be the other side. But one side will lose all of their jobs. So that's quite worrisome. And in addition to job losses, I think there's been concerns about the kind of income inequality that these technologies can generate in a number of ways. One is sometimes the technologies come to further help those who have high skills and who tend to be those who are already being paid well. So it tends to increase the income disparity, or that it could create a winner-take-all market for new products and services that sort of widens up further the gap. But I think it's far from a foregone conclusion, and some have argued that the new technologies, this view of the new technologies and labor market is incomplete at best, and that it is incorrect on the merits for the same reasons that it was incorrect during past technological revolutions. They argued that the disruptions have been a feature of economic transformation since the first industrial revolution, and similar dire predictions of large-scale job destructions that were made in previous episodes have failed to materialize, and there's no reason to expect the fourth industrial revolution to be any different. And here at Brookings, we have been working on this issue to better understand the implications that are unique to Africa and to inform the global debate with an African's lens, because what we've noticed is that part of the entire discussion was really mainly focused on the advanced economies, which kind of raises the question as to what are really the relevance for Africa. In this regard, the World Bank's report is very timely and very informative. I encourage you to read it, not to steal the thunder of the authors who will present on this soon. One main takeaway is that the global future of work is likely to play out differently in Africa than in the rest of the world due to different underlying conditions low levels of human capital in a particularly large informal sector. In other words, given the unique future of Africa's labor markets, it's going to play out there differently than it will in advanced economies. And you don't hear much about this unique perspective. So we are fortunate to have a diverse and excellent panel moderated by Albert to delve deeper into the issues and recommendations in the report and share their perspective on the subject. By way of disclosure, and one of the panelists is associated with MasterCard Foundation, Tricia Williams, and Brookings Independence required that I disclose that they are some of the founders of our work on youth unemployment on the continent. But it's a foundation that has a bold ambition to create 30 million jobs for young people on the continent by 2030. You'll get to hear from her as well. But so before I move on to the presentation and panel discussion, please join me to welcome to the podium the Executive Director for his brief remarks.
Thank you very much, and just want to say hello to everybody. My name is Jean-Claude Chachouan. I represent 23 countries, mostly Francophone Africa, at the board of the World Bank. And I would like to really thank Albert and all the organizers of this launch of the Future of Work in Africa. I think this is a very timely document that will really help really in the continent how to we will move in the in the policy and also in practice on how we try to really increase job in Africa. Most of the country I represent are low-income countries, so I would like to really take that perspective here, that angle here, and really see, tell you how we see things, really, from that point of view. Before I maybe tell you about how we approach this issue here, I would like to really say that, I concur with the main message of the publication. And I think for us, we don't think that digital technology will have a negative consequence, globally in Africa. On the contrary, I think, and many studies also have shown that in Africa, digital technology will, increase job in Africa. But let me take 2 or 3 minutes to explain to you how we see things in the, from the low-income country perspective. The first thing we are seeing is that, the problem of job also in Africa and in low-income countries is not only a problem of growth, because many of the countries that I represent are having, decent level of growth. If you take West Africa, the level of growth, average level of growth there is 7% for the last 5 years. In Central Africa, they have 2 decades of decent growth, but in 2014, as you know, with the decrease in oil price, there was a recession, but now with some reform, they are coming out of the recession, and we are beginning to see some level of growth there also. So in general, when you look in Africa, if we go beyond even Francophone Africa and look at in Africa in general, excluding Nigeria, South Africa, and Angola, who are the 3 biggest economy of the region, and which represent like more than 50%, growth in other region, it's average the last, decade, 6-7%. So decent growth. But the problem is that this growth really is not inclusive. It's not creating the level of job we want. It's not creating the level of the job we want, and that's why, the impact also on poverty reduction, it's not enough. So really, the you know, the impact, the elasticity of that growth on poverty is very low. And that's where we really have a concern. And for us, we think the problem lies in the fact that that growth is coming, you know, from a particular sector, mostly extractive sector. And that extractive sector is not really creating the level of growth that we want. And that's where the problem is. So, and also, you can tell me, you know, the country needs to use the resource of the extractive sector to maybe develop the other sector. But there we have a problem of governance and a lot of problems. But what we see is really that also that Africa in general and many low-income countries, their structure of economy have not changed for the last 50 years, almost the same, based on extractive and you know, primary sector. So for us, we link job and economic transformation together. For us, it's almost the same issue. So to create job, we need also to embrace the agenda of economic transformation. For us, really, we see that together. And that's also why we are pushing in the bank to, you know, this is a theme that is very dear to us at the bank, World Bank, and that's where really we are coming from. And that agenda of job and economic transformation, we have a couple of elements on this. The characteristic of low-income countries that, you know, you have very, you know, they are doing a lot of things in terms of, you know, doing business reform, etc., but one of the main issues is lack of infrastructure, a huge gap of infrastructure. So for us, one of the first elements of that agenda is how we can really close that gap of infrastructure, in particular in some sector like energy, also digital. We need digital infrastructure there. So this is one of the first elements we see there. You know, the access to electricity is very, very low in many African countries. In some country like Chad, I have less than 10% access to electricity. Niger, 12%. Burkina Faso, maybe 20%. So very low. So for us, this is one agenda that we need to take forward to really see how we create jobs. So this is very one element that is very, very important to us. Another element is human capital. Really, you know, study in the bank have shown that, you know, human capital is really one of the main factors of the wealth of a nation. In developing country, in developed countries, it's like maybe two-tiered, you know, like 65 to 70%. But in low-income country like mine, it's, you know, the less than 10%. So really, we need to really focus also on the human capital. The quality of the education is very low. We need to work really on that. But also, you know, vocational, you know, training and building skills, entrepreneurship also. This is something that we need. So this is also something, you know, on the agenda that is very important for us. And also, you know, including, you know, digital entrepreneurship that and skills that we need to build. So the digital will really help us, you know, on this agenda also. Another element, the third element that we see here also, it's really on the manufacturing. And here there is a controversy. People think maybe today with the technology, you know, some of the industry where, you know, we need low-skilled labor or, you know, will not, you know, Africa, we see in China that China in some of the, you know, the sector like textile, you know, when salary of people increase, you know, it's been transferred to other region, that may not happen with technology in Africa. So there is a big debate here, but for us, we still think that, you know, manufacturing should be part of the menu. Maybe not in all the country that we cover. They are small country, but in some country like Ethiopia, you know, some of DRC, we think that manufacturing should be still part of the menu. And this is where also, you know, agro-industry can play a part. And we think also that, you know, the way we see job will still be very important in the agricultural sector, because many of our country, you know, 80%, 60% of people work in the agricultural sector. There is a problem there because we need to increase, you know, productivity. But here also technology can really help in increasing productivity in the agricultural sector. So this is also part of the menu for us. And then we have the digital economy itself. This is very, very important, I think. And I will tell you, you know, give you a couple of, you know, example why we think this is very, digital economy is very important in Africa. The first, of course, and as I mentioned, is that, you know, there are a lot of studies showing that digital will increase, you know, will create job in Africa. So this is no doubt about this weekend, you know, we completely agree with that. But the second thing is really that the digital can increase productivity in other sectors. For me, even before, you know, one of the characteristics of many of the countries that I represented, the informal sector is very, very important. Very, very important. And for me, with digital, I see a hope to transform and increase the productivity in the informal sector. And I can take a couple of examples. One example, you know, everybody here knows, is Uber. You know, before, when I go to a country, I go to Paris, I will see people approaching me when I get out. You know, do you need a car or do you need a taxi? You know, these are people in the informal sector. But today with the Uber, you know, they're increasing their productivity, you know, at a level that is very, very important. There is also an example in the agricultural sector, in Kenya. There is a platform where people can sell, you know, somebody is selling bananas, but you register in the platform, and then in the platform you get clients. So what you just need to do is to go and deliver the banana, you know, in different clients. So it can increase really tremendously the productivity. For me, digital economy is a hope for the informal sector. I don't worry for informal sector anymore with the digital technology. But what we'll have to create is to create platform. We need to create digital payment. This is also very important. So for all the agenda of digital economies, infrastructure, of course, we need infrastructure, digital infrastructure. We need digital payment. We need digital platform. This is very important. We need also digital skill and create digital entrepreneurship. I think I don't want to be too long. I have too many things to say, but just to say, really, I'm pleased to be here. This is a very, very important, you know, document for us. And again, thank you very much, Albert, for producing this document. Thank you.
So a warm good afternoon to all. Thank you for those kind introductions. So this report is really a team effort. As you can see, co-lead authors June Choi and Zainab Usman, who are both here with us. June having authored the chapter on digital technologies, Zainab on social protection. And in addition, the works benefited from the authorship of Moussa Blimpo and Solomon Owusu on human capital, and by Cédric Okou and Professor Pierre Nguyen-Ke on informality. And you'll see in my presentation that a lot of the themes that Jean-Claude mentioned really come together. And in fact, let me just, to introduce the topic, get you to focus on what Jean-Claude mentioned as the jobs and economic transformation agenda. So I thought I would explain briefly what we mean by this concept. It's sort of recently coined concept at the World Bank. It means productivity-driven growth for us. It means growth when people shift from lower to higher productivity activities, whether they're shifting to other activities or where they are, and then they do things better. So, you know, you think of the term economic transformation as an economist, and you've heard something like it, which is structural transformation. And it's importantly linked to that. That's about how the structure of economies changes as people and other resources move across sectors, from agriculture to manufacturing and services, and within sectors, ideally from less to more efficient businesses. But structural transformation isn't always welfare improving. People can move from, say, low productivity agriculture to even lower productivity services in urban areas. So the term economic transformation is about the productivity enhancing parts of structural transformation. But importantly, it also includes the other main part of productivity growth, which arises within firms and farms as they innovate. So as they do things better within the firms. And the innovation isn't just about doing completely new to the world things. Importantly, across the world, it's mainly about adopting better technologies. So that's what we're focusing on in this report, how economic transformation or productivity growth can be driven by technology adoption, in particular digital technologies, as well as by the adoption of complementary technologies by individuals and by businesses. And we're particularly interested, as Jean-Claude mentioned, on inclusive productivity growth, namely that kind of growth that creates more and better jobs for low-income people, as jobs are the best sustainable way to exit poverty. So I'd just like to start by asking why this, what we had in the title, making the right decisions to secure the future of work, including through digital technologies, should be urgent for African policymakers. So you see that we emphasize the high number of poor people, the growing youth population. Those make it imperative to take actions to make sure that Africa's digital future is actually inclusive. To invest in the kinds of technologies that will create better jobs for less skilled workers as well. Digital technology adoption doesn't necessarily have to be inclusive, and it's sort of a conditional statement. It may be inclusive as long as policymakers put in place the right environment. So, you know, as Jean-Claude mentioned, we in many developed countries, we see the benefits from adopting skill-biased technologies like the internet being skewed towards people who are higher skilled. So policymakers must ensure from the beginning that the adoption of digital technologies reduce rather than worsen the digital divide. It's not automatic. And we also mentioned global risks emanating from climate shocks, from fragility, from economic integration, from population transitions. They're also transforming the work landscape and lend an urgency to more inclusive technology adoption. And finally, the recent interest by African policymakers in digital technologies provides an entry point. It's sort of a window of opportunity to broaden the policy debate to facilitate all types of technology adoption that are complementary to digital as part of what we term an inclusive productivity growth agenda. We like to say that Africa can't really benefit from the Internet of Things without actually having the complementary things as well. So, African farmers clearly need better tractors. They need better irrigation systems. They actually need not just the tangible things like tractors and irrigation systems, but they need the intangible things like better management capabilities. Focusing on digital technologies also importantly serves as an entry point to a broader policy discussion on all complementary types of technology adoption to digital. In this report, we claim that Africa has an opportunity to develop a more inclusive future of work agenda with opportunities for lower-skilled workers. Why do we make this claim? So it's a conditional claim. It depends on policymakers creating the right environment. But there are a number of structural characteristics that really are about low-income and fragile countries, and many of which happen to be in sub-Saharan Africa, that we list here, sort of the low level of technology adoption, only 8% of employment on average in manufacturing, low levels of consumption, especially of higher quality food products and other services, low levels of education and skills, almost 90% of total employment in the informal sector, most of it in agriculture. So what are three important possible reasons why the future of work may play out differently in Africa. So this is sort of the crux of my part of the presentation. A first reason comes from the supply side of product markets. So there's a lower chance of losing jobs from automation because there's actually been little automation to date. Manufacturing is very small. Most workers are in the informal sector. The adoption of sort of worker replacing digital technologies like robots is not likely to displace many people over the next few years. So there's a window of opportunity there. So that's the first claim. A second possible reason has to do from the demand side of product markets. So where do jobs come from, generating jobs? It comes from firms producing more. That comes from consumers buying more. So demand arguably could be much more elastic, more responsive to the price reductions that are expected to come from adoption of digital technologies and other technologies. So in contrast to developed countries, where there's already close to satiation in certain specific types of products, in Africa there's a lot of pent-up demand for higher quality foodstuffs, for higher quality services. So the price reductions are expected to make these products affordable for mass consumption, and therefore that should allow for sufficiently large increases in production to create more jobs, provided those products are actually competitively produced in Africa. And then the third opportunity, and I actually think this is the most interesting, comes from what we could call worker enhancing rather than worker replacing, low-skill biased digital technologies rather than skill-biased. So what are those kinds of things? If you think of what digital allows one to do, allows firms to do, allows people to do, it provides video, it provides voice, it makes very quick, easy mathematical calculations. So it's precisely, it should be helpful for people with low literacy and low numeracy skills. So you could think of voice and video-based e-extension services for farms and for firms. You could think of different kinds of mobile payment systems for the unbanked that are really easy to access, much easier than otherwise. You could think of, like was mentioned, Uber-like platforms that don't require, like, so when you have an Uber-like platform, the person providing the service doesn't have to make the calculation of how much change to give back. So these should, in principle, provide economic opportunities for the lower income, lower educated, lower skilled workers, provided the business environment is there to provide the incentives for entrepreneurs to actually produce those kinds of apps and in an affordable way for low-skilled people to actually want to adopt them. So I wanted to just present one piece of evidence about what we know so far about these types of more inclusive benefits. So this is a study that was published in the American Economic Review this spring. And it was able to identify causal impacts rather than just correlations. It takes advantage of faster internet when new areas became connected to 10 different undersea cables at different times in the late 2000s and to 2010s, and that greatly increased the speed and capacity of terrestrial networks. So the likelihood that a worker is employed increased by over 3% in South Africa, over 7% in these eight countries that are part of the survey reported, and then there were similar results found in an Afrobarometer survey across nine other countries. So these findings were then broken down by occupation. And so you see in the top one, skilled versus unskilled, you see that, in fact, predictably, since internet is a skill-biased digital technology, it combines better sort of with more skilled people, the probability of holding a skilled job increased relative to the unskilled. And then in the second little clump, you see that it's the moderately skilled occupations that contributed the most to the increase in jobs. But what I want to bring your attention to is the last clump, and especially where we circled it in red, where they examined the impact on workers by educational attainment. And it turns out they found that increases in employment rates were of similar magnitude for primary educated people at the same level as secondary and tertiary. So this is quite an important finding. It raises questions regarding what is driving this. It could, for instance, be that what secondary and tertiary schooling teaches relative to primary is not that useful for some businesses, and they prefer training these workers right after completing primary school. Clearly, more work is needed to understand the channels through which this is occurring, But it highlights, you know, that skilled workers will still benefit more from skill-biased technologies. And then there's this whole agenda that this doesn't look at, is what would be the impact of the low-skill-biased digital technologies, like the voice-based and the video-based e-extension services. So lots to do still in this area to better understand. And finally, before handing off to Zainab, I just wanted to set the stage for, you know, what are the right questions for Africa? Sort of, in our report, we focus on four areas, which are very linked again to the areas that Jean-Claude mentioned, that is the digital technologies and the required digital infrastructure, linked, of course, with the electricity infrastructure, human capital, informality, and social protection. And so I just want to emphasize what some of the most novel features in each of these four areas are before Zainab goes in more detail. So in the first area, we argue that improving the availability of affordable internet is a prerequisite, you know, without which the adoption of any other technologies that sort of ride on the internet can't be provided. We emphasize the potential benefits from regional harmonization, so supported by sort of increased regulatory capacity through regional hubs. So rather than having each of the 48 sub-Saharan African countries each having quite difficult regulatory expertise, quite complicated, why not have, for instance, Kenya, Uganda, Rwanda as a starting point come together and then think jointly about sort of would it make sense to have things like regional spectrum auctions, holding auctions at the same time across three countries, and then allowing ex post trading again across the region, or asset sharing across the region. So, and think of different experiments happening to see how to do this better, since it's so important. In the second area, on human capital, we argue that the challenge involves both a large stock of low-skilled workers and the flow of youth, and that it'll be important to provide an appropriate business environment for entrepreneurs to develop these solutions for lower-skilled workers to learn as they work. In the third area, on informality, we argue that there has to be a shift from traditional formalization policies to policies that actually help boost the productivity of informal farms and firms and their workers. And so as the successful firms grow, they'll naturally want to seek formal services and become formalized. And finally, in the last area, we argue for a rebalancing of government and development partner expenditures in line with the structure of labor markets. So I'll now switch and let Zainab finish by going more in detail in these areas. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to Mark for providing that good introduction. As he mentioned, there are four key areas we cover in the report, which we identify as key pillars that will support or that can support the digital transformation across African countries. So the first pillar is digital technologies, and here we emphasize inclusive digital technologies, which, as Mark explained, are technologies that are worker-enhancing, but they also they can be used by lower-skilled workers. So we actually argue that there are two key reasons why low-skilled workers across African countries will benefit from these digital technologies. The first, and these two key reasons are illustrated by this diagram on the slide, which looks very complicated, but I promise you there's a very simple logic to it. So the first reason is that, you know, across many African countries, the key sectors that are susceptible to automation, such as manufacturing and other industries, actually constitute a small share of national employment, and this was, in a sense, alluded to by Mark. Across many African countries, you find that the manufacturing sector, for example, contributes less than 10% of national employment. And if you look at the figure on the slide, there's an orange dotted line. The space covered by that area represents the employment that will be displaced by automation in these African countries, and it's a very small area. Compared to the area covered by the blue line, which represents, you know, lost employment to automation in these sectors in high-income countries and OECD countries. So basically, we're not going to see that massive displacement of labor in such sectors as manufacturing. The second reason why low-skilled workers across African countries are likely to benefit from digital technologies is that these digital innovations allow for the creation of new products and a whole new category of subsectors across African countries with associated jobs. So you find that in many African countries, entrepreneurs can and will create digital solutions in sectors such as retail, such as agriculture, such as education, and a whole range of other services. And importantly, with these digital solutions, you find that a lot of people can use them, but they can also learn in the process, as Mark explained. The second key pillar for us is human capital. And a key question that we address in this report is what area or what areas of human capital should be prioritized to enable and to support the digital transformation in African countries. So we summarize evidence in the report, such as that represented by, you know, the figure on the slide, which shows that across many African countries, in big countries such as Nigeria, in Guinea, in Mali, etc., many adults, actually up to 40% or even more than 40% of adults are basically illiterate. They cannot read, they have little or no numeracy and literacy skills. So we argue that in many of such countries, the human capital challenges involve two things. So there's a large stock of low-skilled workers, and there's also a continuous flow of people into the labor market. And what do we mean by this? So in terms of the large stock of low-skilled workers, about 60% of the labor force in many, many countries are adults who are ill-equipped for jobs. And, you know, added to this stock is the fact that every year you have young people, you have people joining the labor market who are similarly ill-equipped. You know, according to some figures, up to 11 million people join the labor market each year in African countries. So when we think of solutions to these human capital challenges, we need to think about also focusing on the stock and flows and how to increase their numeracy and literacy skills. And certainly digital solutions can help in that regard. So the third key pillar is that we also need to, generally there needs to be a focus on increasing informal sector productivity. So before we launch into that discussion, I would like to highlight some key features of the informal sector in African countries. So first of all, it is very large, and you know, about 90% of it constitutes about 90% of total employment in many countries. I mean, of course, these varies across different countries on the continent. The second key feature is that it is mostly in agriculture. And the third key feature is that it comprises, and this is very surprising, even for us, you know, when we were working on this, that it comprises of not just small firms, as you would think. It's not just the petty trader, you know. It's also large firms, fairly large firms that operate in informality and in the informal sector. So one of our key arguments, really, is that policies that have traditionally focused on formalization have not been that effective, they've not been that impactful across many African countries. And therefore, we need a different approach. And what is that approach? The new approach is that we need to focus on improving the productivity of the informal sector. So what it also means is that the traditional formalization policies, we should continue with them, but we need to be more focused in what we do with them. That is, we need to target those large informal firms that aggressively compete and sometimes undermine formal firms in the economy. So in an effort to increase this informal sector productivity, digital solutions can also help. So they can help with increasing access to information and to credit markets. They can help increase financial inclusion, to build skills, etc. And you find that when firms become more productive, when they grow, then formalization becomes a more organic and natural process. So the fourth key pillar and the last one that we focus on in the report is the need to extend social protection coverage. We all know how important social protection is in terms of mitigating risks for individuals, but enabling them to also take on more risk and become entrepreneurs, as well as the poverty reduction dimension. Unfortunately, across many African countries, social protection coverage is very, very low compared to many other regions across the world, as this figure on the chart illustrates. So you find that 8 in 10 people in African countries are not covered by a safety net, they're not under any pension scheme, and they're not just covered by any social protection and labor policy. So this reality then motivates one of our key recommendations in the report that social protection and labor policies should seek to align with the current structure of labor markets in African countries. So this means that, you know, social protection spending by governments and by also importantly by development partners should be rebalanced to cover people, especially informal workers and those in transition. And, you know, the word transition is very, very important because in a situation where you have an economy that is changing rapidly, as with quite a number of African countries, people move across jobs from rural to urban areas, from small urban centers to larger urban centers, across industries, across sectors, but importantly, across borders. And we're all aware of, you know, the Africa Continental Free Trade Area as illustrative of attempts to increase regional and economic integration. So, you know, social protection is needed to to mitigate risks for such individuals. So this rebalancing that we propose and that we advocate for, we believe can be achieved by three key things or in three key ways. So first of all, by improving revenue collection more broadly. Secondly, by improving the efficiencies of current allocations of social spending, using instruments such as public expenditure reviews to find out where the inefficiencies are and to do the rebalancing. And finally, there's also a need to effectively coordinate development assistance. In many African countries, social protection is provided by development partners. Finally, and this is the concluding slide, what should be done? What should governments do? But I think this also refers to other stakeholders in addition to governments, so development partners and just key stakeholders, you know, who are invested in this. And really, we conclude, as you know, Mark has already alluded to, on a very positive note, that the future of work in Africa is positive, is going to be positive, but this is really conditional on the right decisions being made by governments, but by also other key stakeholders. And what are these right decisions? We summarize them as three C's. And also three C's are a bit catchy. We couldn't resist it. So these three C's are capital, capacity, and competition. And I'll quickly walk you through them. In terms of capital, our key message is that, you know, businesses and enterprises, sure, they need financial resources, but they really need more than that to be able to expand in existing markets and enter new ones. They need better human capital for entrepreneurs, but also for workers. But they also need physical capital and infrastructure, as our executive director, you know, so eloquently and passionately explained. They need, you know, reliable electricity and transport networks. Not much really can be done without electricity. And I come from Nigeria. I know all the challenges and all the bad jokes about power outages. So businesses need that, as well as digital infrastructure. So internet, broadband, and you know, things like that. Secondly, there's a need to increase the capacity of governments to make the needed investments in social protection. And this specifically is meant to allow for greater risk taken by entrepreneurs. So currently, you know, people might want to move across borders. They want to, may want to establish an outlet somewhere, but it's very difficult because of all the risks that people face, weak insurance markets and things like that. Also to support workers to transition across and between jobs. Finally, is the need to promote competition. And this entails perhaps two key things: upstream competition in the provision of the very infrastructure that we mentioned, electricity, transportation, and digital infrastructure, but also to allow businesses adopt new technologies and expand production. So really, to conclude, we do believe that the future of work in Africa is bright. Personally, I'm very optimistic about Africa. So many young entrepreneurs, so many women, some of the friends that I went to high school with, you know, people doing amazing things. But we, as, you know, development partners, as governments, we also need to support these people to make the future of work in Africa bright. Thank you very much.
So, good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon. I thought after such an energizing presentation, you will all be fired up, aren't you? Oh, yeah. Great. My name is Albert Zufak. I'm the chief economist for Africa at the World Bank, and it's a great pleasure and honor for me to moderate this panel to get into more in-depth discussion in the findings of this excellent report, and absolutely excellent, and I'm not saying that just because it's been produced by my colleagues in my office, but really it's a pleasure. So I'm really inviting you to read it because it's clearly coming up with quite, you know, innovative findings. The first is that, contrary to the gloom and doom picture that we've been seeing on, you know, digital technologies displacing workers across the world, what this is finding is that the future of work can actually be brighter in Africa and will be brighter for a good number of reasons. And one of the first reasons is basically that to lose something, you first have to have it. And we don't have that many jobs to start with, right? So the displacement effect is going to be minimal. Manufacturing is just 8% of the workforce in Africa. But more importantly, this report is pointing to the fact that, you know, most of the workforce is informal, and technologies, digital technologies, can actually, you know, help boost productivity of these informal workers and therefore create a brighter picture than we have seen elsewhere. So Africa does have the potential for, and I would even say an opportunity for, creating a future of work that is really inclusive. So we need to really ponder on that, and this is coming in contradiction to many reports that have been published not long ago. But what I even like more about the report and the presentation is that it's not just telling us what may happen. It's telling us, you know, how countries can actually achieve that more inclusive future of work. And I like the focus on the three C's, right? So capital, not just physical capital, digital capital as well, but more importantly, the need to emphasize the analog complements to digital, We will not do the digital without electricity, for example. So the second C is about capacity, the skills. And I love the distinction between the stock and the flow, because number of African, you know, do not necessarily have the skills to be, creating all those softwares or making money, on digital platforms. But they can actually exploit the low-skill digital technologies to create their own employment or to boost productivity of wherever they are. And I really like that. The other very important finding from the report that I really got from the report is this shift in mindset when we discuss informality. It's shifting away from formalization, getting a net to trap them and put them into the formal sector like they were cows that we are herding, but the focus on raising their productivity, because at the end of the day, when they become large enough, they cannot escape the net. So I think this is a change in mindset, and we really need to discuss a little bit this further. So to get this, I have a wonderful panel here, as you can see, and I'm absolutely happy that Mel is the minority on the panel. So I'm happy to really have a panel where, the gender balance is in favor of, the ladies. So it's great. And I'm doing this because we are really pushing for women empowerment in Africa in another report that we have written. Now, for this panel, I have next to me Mary Hallward Dreamer. And Mary is a senior economic advisor in the finance and competitiveness and innovation global practice at the World Bank. Welcome, Mary. So next to Mary is Tricia Williams, and Tricia is from the MasterCard Foundation, and she will certainly tell us a little bit more about youth employment and digital employment in the youth. Next to her is Professor Lema Senbet, who is not only a renowned academic at the University of Maryland, the mayor chair, professor of finance, but also associated to Brookings here. And last but not least is Jean Choi, who is a co-author of this report. So welcome to all of you. May I ask you, starting with you, Mary, to very quickly, in 2-3 minutes, having your reaction to these findings, how they align with what you have seen, and you particularly has been involved in a number of analytical work on the future of work, on manufacturing. You authored this work on trouble in the making. How do you find this report aligning with the existing literature? Can you share your perspective here?
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to be part of this panel. I mean, I really enjoyed this report. And I think, so it was, quote, a companion to a WDR, which took a global perspective. And I think taking it to the region really does highlight a number of differences in how the messages and how the agenda may play out. And I think that's actually the team to be commended for really doing that and adding considerable value in that. So I have written a global report called Trouble in the Making with a question mark. And in part because it was inspired by this sense of, real sort of, not quite panic, but just sort of a sense that technology was going to be wrecking havoc. And so wanting to look at the evidence. And there are some areas that are more concerning than others. So the only twist, unfortunately, I would put on your first lesson of there may be fewer jobs to be disrupted and lost, I would say the bigger concern is the jobs that may never come. Right, and there is this sort of flying geese model, and sort of as raised, China's wages are rising, and this idea that some of the low-skilled, labor-intensive manufacturing may shift out of China into other countries, and wouldn't Africa like to be able to have more of it done there? That may not be happening. The country that is both producing the most robots, importing the most robots, and installing the most robots is China. Right, and so that they are very much sort of aware of this and actively engaged in not having too much of their production moving offshore. You know, as wages continue to rise, that may shift. But automation may mean a source of potential job creation isn't going to be there in quite the same way. At the same time, I do think there's also a window of opportunity. So one of the things we did try and do was disaggregate across different kinds of technology and different within manufacturing, different sectors. So the sectors that Africa is more active in are, in fact, those that are least susceptible to automation. And so it does give some window of opportunity within manufacturing and with other things to be able to gather some of the skills, to get involved in some of this, and be able to potentially keep upgrading. So the need to really shift, there may be a little bit more time. But what one of the other things that I think is really interesting is in fact, that third point, right, which is really looking at how within the informal sector, this agenda matters. So I'm very much involved in this jobs and economic transformation agenda within the World Bank, and I think it really is important sort of for two things. So often we've talked about inclusive growth. So I get asked, how is JET different from inclusive growth? And so to me, this economic transformation is sort of one step down from growth. So really, where do we see changes? So it's not just that you have this high growth. If it is coming from natural resources, that's not really transformational. It gives you some income, which is good. But to really get the dynamics that are going to change things sort of at scale, you need these deeper changes. So I really like that emphasis on economic transformation. And then I also really like the fact that it's jobs, because simplifying two easy ways out of poverty is one is transfers. So you can take some of this income, you can distribute it. That can be a good thing too. But again, it doesn't have that dynamics. The most sustainable way out of poverty is by increasing job opportunities, increasing labor income, right? That is by far the labor's sort of the most important asset for the poor. Being able to use that more productively is critical. So to me, this shifting the sort of inclusive growth to economic transformation and jobs is focusing that much more closely on what we need to do. And I think this report, in looking at the informal sector, where the vast majority of the people are, is appropriate and comes up with a lot of ways, which is different from what we usually hear, about how these kinds of technologies really can be productivity enhancing. So I think this report is putting on the table a sort of a whole set of agenda, and they've got some evidence. It's an agenda where we need to keep building that evidence. But that, to me, is a huge contribution, is not just assuming that this is all skill-biased, that there's some really important, simple ways that this can be making a difference on the ground. So very much congratulations to the team.
Thank you very much, Mary. And I think the team really deserves those congratulations, you know, as they have seen. Thank you. Trish, so Tricia, you've been working on Africa with the MasterCard Foundation. One of the areas this report is highlighting is the need to build those skills. And skills are certainly digital skills. And when we generally think digital skills, people think of coding, of tertiary level skills. But what this report is also saying is, you know, technology may actually be coming with some potential for lowly educated people, low-skilled people, but that could be transformative as well. There are examples of farmers receiving extension messages on their phones, not smartphones, just simple phones, text messaging as a way to actually promote agricultural extension, voice, you know, for alphabetization programs, you know, all those that could actually help boosting productivity. Can you share a little bit your perspective from the MasterCard Foundation, you know, view? What kind of digital skills do you see being really implemented and making a difference in Africa?
Well, thank you so much for the invitation, the opportunity to be here. As Kuhl said, the MasterCard Foundation is focused in Africa. We are separate and independent from the MasterCard Corporation, endowed by a generous one-time gift from the corporation. And we're working currently across several countries in Africa, working specifically on youth employment. So we think about work all the time, Africa, and this is what we're primarily focused on. So a couple maybe comments first before I get to the point about digital skills. Mm. So I think this is really, as Mary said, an important contribution in localizing and regionalizing the discussion on future of work. So I think it's an important step forward, but I would hope it's just the first step of many, because I think what we've observed is the need for more of this dialogue to happen in different countries, by different actors, that there needs to be more attention to the future of work and to really maybe provide different frameworks, different narratives, rather than interpreting the traditional narratives around automation, the gig economy, et cetera. And one of the things I guess I think I'd put forward is that maybe we've overemphasized technology a bit. Given how many people are living in an analog world, although technology will play a big role in the present and future, I think some of these things are maybe underemphasized in how much they're going to shape work opportunities in Africa and elsewhere. And notably, you know, I think they've been pointed out here in this report as risks, but I think they might even be considered drivers. So climate change will cause big displacements of people from different areas that will really shape work opportunities. Same with global value chains, the jobs that might never come, social inclusion as well. And then the other thing I think I'd say maybe before addressing the digital skills part is I think we have to go a little bit farther in surfacing the critical decisions that are most important right now. So in a world in which, you know, governments are saying to us all the time, this is great, you want to focus on youth employment with us because we have a big youth employment problem of today. So not like making the trade-offs between what are the problems of today and what are the problems of 10, 20 years out. So where are the things where we actually really have critical windows of opportunity to make differences right now? Because that's a really ambitious policy list that was put up in this report. And I think it would be good to have more discussion about where are the things that we actually have a window of opportunity to make changes right now and that will really determine some of the future pathways. In terms of digital skills, I mean, we're working closely with, as I said, in a number of countries, and we have a report coming out very soon with Caribou Digital around transformational upskilling, which is a really exciting thing that we're seeing with different platforms who are investing in worker skills. So you're starting to see businesses seeing the potential of investing in their worker skills. So, for instance, Jumia. People know Jumia. You know, in Africa, they're selling their things online, but they're actually teaching people how to take better photos of their products to put them online. Or Link in Kenya, linking informal workers. They're saying, you know, we're going to set up a carpentry shop so that our carpenters are better skilled and can provide better services to the customers on the platform. So this is taking different forms. So you're starting to see some real investment not only in the analog skills but the digital skills as well. So I think, you know, we'd say that it's really going to be in hand in hand, the analog and the digital skills together.
Excellent. Thank you so much. So, Professor Lema Sembet,
by the way, coming to you. I like this report, okay? So I enjoyed reading this report. I think what I liked was that it has an opportunity to shift the conversation. I like the idea that this old thesis, let's call this old, which is kind of grappling with job losses associated with manufacturing, and then maybe creating these new sectors. By the way, they have never explained about what these new sectors are, right? We don't know, but that's what they say. I think the point of this paper is that there is no old. And there's no new. There is just a sector. Mm-hmm. And this is pretty analogous to this debate that has gone on for a long time about this premature decentralization of Africa, mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. Which I think is a wrong debate. Mm-hmm. Because the thinking is that, you know, you have to move from agriculture, manufacture, but you have to transform everywhere. Mm-hmm. You have to create value chain. The conversation has to be value. So it's pretty analogous to that. So then the second point is that, you know, Africa has staggering problems. I think what Albert did not mention is that I decided to go on a five-year mission to Africa. I was actually heading up African Economic Research Consortium. The university was very generous, gave me a long leave of absence. And I got to see virtually the whole continent. Whenever I run into a governor of central bank of a specific country, I say, I know more about Africa than you do. Yeah. So but what I noticed was that one day I just woke up. So the problems are so staggering. You can't do this. You can't deal with that business as usual. You have to go outside the box. You have to innovate. You know, the whole emphasis on innovation, entrepreneurship, has to be part of a robust conversation, part of support coming from the other entities. So by the way, innovation, I'm actually defining it more broadly. I'm not giving total technology. By the way, innovation has been going on since time immemorial, right? Before all of you were born. The Roman Empire. Yeah. In fact, one thing that people do not know is when they talk about the M-Pesa in Kenya, is that there was another entity called Equity Bank. This Equity Bank with no technology, but was able to identify neglected areas and which are shunned by post-colonial banks like, you know, Barclays. And this guy decided to go into this arid desert area. By the way, he did that to make money. Okay. And he created this microfinance entity. Now, this has become sometimes the largest, sometimes the second largest, and got listed in the Nairobi Stock Exchange. So this is like transforming informal finance into the stock market. So innovation could occur without technology. I think that's one of the points that you were saying. So really, the one thing that I would like you to encourage is what does it mean to innovate in various sectors, especially agriculture? That's a dominant economy in Africa. Mm-hmm. We need to innovate in agriculture. Innovate both entrepreneurially, both in terms of value chain, and the report is not that explicit, is that right? So we need to go into the nitty-gritty of what does it mean to innovate, and how do we create an enabling environment, agriculture really being the point. And second is, I agree with your policies, competition policies, you know. Basically, not a stifling entry, and even playing field. That's definitely a very good suggestion. But I think one thing that we keep on ignoring, and that's something became very close to my thinking in Africa, was the political economy. Mm-hmm. The political, we come up with very well-designed instruments, features, and policies. Who's going to implement this? And when would that be implemented? So and now we have come up with the largest trading bloc in the entire globe. By the way, in terms of population. Yeah, yes, semi-optimistic. Sorry. Now, I think, assuming that also works, talking about how integrating, these thin, small markets and integrated innovation across national boundaries is something that I think we should actually look into in this paper as well. And then finally, one thing that I liked about Kenya, by the way, my headquarters was Kenya, but I was going around the whole continent. It's a pan-African. I was spending more time on the sky than on the ground. But one thing about Kenya is a very entrepreneurial, innovative group, especially the young guys. And then every time people ask me, I was of Ethiopian origin in other countries, I say, walk across the border, see what's going on. But one of the big issues, and I don't want to single out Kenya necessarily, I think when we draw up policies, we should also think about corruption, or the anti-corruption policies. Because there are certain countries who seem to have all kinds of ingredients, including, by the way, skills in Kenya. They can only go so far, is that right? And there is some binding constraint. So really, the political economy, the anti-corruption policies. By the way, policies do not alone, even in anti-corruption policies, do not get implemented. And I'm going to finish with this. Okay. One day, I woke up in the morning, and they have by the way, the media in Nairobi is very robust. And there is this thing called Nation. So I kind of look forward to reading the Nation. It's almost like the Washington Post. So someday, I just woke up. The front page says shameless. This is a list of who is who implicated in corruption. Okay, then I thought that this is going to make a big difference. And then in a month, the news disappeared. Okay? And I think part of the reason was that people started asking, yeah, you have a shame list. How about two or three individuals who are off the list? And they singled out someone who is very closely aligned with the decision makers. So even when you have these anti-corruption policies, you will have difficulty implementing them. So anyway,
thank you very much, Lema. Thank you. Now, June, you are the third quarter, and you are on this panel not to defend yourself, but you know, I would like you to react to some of the points. You know, what I'm hearing is a broad agreement that you know the report is timely, it's helpful, it's raising very very pertinent questions complementing the WDR 2019. But there are also some questions, you know. What about the jobs that may never come? Are we overplaying the technology card? How about youth entrepreneurship? You know, then the political economy, as we hear from Lema, you know, corruption, all these things. You know, how do you react to all this first barrage?
Yes, first of all, I want to thank all the three panelists for your very insightful comments. Some of them actually addressed in our report, and then those we have not addressed extensively, maybe we can consider addressing further in our upcoming digital economy flagship. So specifically, I agree with Mary that growth is a necessary but not sufficient condition for job creation. And I also agree with Tricia that we need more than digital technology, that we need a complementary analog asset. And also with the Lema that there is no old and new sector. Any sector can innovate. Yeah. And then also the point about digital technology is important, that it's not we are only emphasizing digital technology. We use digital technology as a cross-cutting theme, which can be used in agriculture sector, which we can be used in service sector. We are not saying we should develop ICT sector in Africa. We should use digital technology to transform different sectors. So that's, I think, our key point. In terms of Mary's point about that jobs may never come to Africa, you're right that China may not offshore their production. And also, as we all know, that Adidas closed down their factory in Bangladesh and opened it up in Germany because producing shoes with a 3D printing is cheaper in Germany. So maybe such a reshoring raises a concern for African countries that maybe they cannot follow the traditional industrialization-led growth. However, our report reviewed such evidence, and we saw that such a reshoring is very limited in globally as of today, and then much more limited in Africa. So we just argue that we are not saying we have a lot of opportunity. We are just arguing that there is urgency for African countries to act, because they may have they still have a time to take advantage of low wages and globalization. But I also admit that they should also explore new growth paths, which technology can open up. So the last Lema's point about the political economy, yes, it is true. So it's related also to Tricia's point that upskilling and digital technology, such as Jumia or M-Pesa, it is true that private sector-driven, such as digital upskilling or increasing e-commerce, but I think government has an important role making this such a technology more inclusive. So one example is Alibaba, as a Taobao village in China. So Taobao village is essentially built on government transfer to the rural area and making such a e-commerce more inclusive. So yes, there is a political economy, so such industrial policy or government intervention can bring a good outcome, but also can bring a disaster like corruption and all sorts. So how do we do it is important. But like just to conclude, I think we have a great opportunity today to inform policy discussion and then support such a government, because big data is complementing traditional source of data and also expanding our knowledge. For example, using LinkedIn data, our report shows that digital skill has been growing in 27 African countries, such information we didn't know before. Mm-hmm. And also there has been emerging micro-level evidence, including field experiment about digital app or digital technologies' effect on inclusion. I think we should take advantage of such rich data source and microeconomics tool to really understand, really investigate the best possible policy intervention the government should do
and then development partner with scholars should work together with the government. And some more question we could answer, we could investigate is what are the efficient market structure for to make a technology affordable for all? Or what are the specific technology we should emphasize making supporting more low-skilled or low-educated workers? So all those questions can be addressed today. And I think the fact that this week Nobel Prize awarded by two development economists, which are encouraging us to supporting evidence-based policymaking.
Yes. Excellent. Thank you so much. You know, these are great answers. Now, I think one word that kept coming up before I opened the floor, expression that kept coming up is window of opportunity, right? Window of opportunity, how large it is, how small it is, that's certainly a question for investigation. But when you visit a city like Hawassa in Ethiopia and realize that over the past 5 years, they have actually attracted more than 20,000 manufacturing jobs and growing, then you realize that, robots and 3D printing are not going to invade Africa tomorrow morning, mm-hmm. right? We probably still have some time before it happens. The question is how fast, those technologies are going to be preventing those jobs from coming to Africa. And more importantly, I think the point that came out here also is this idea of leapfrogging, this idea of a different development path, and this idea of leveraging technology for all sectors, including manufacturing, because manufacturing is changing itself, right? So digital can actually help, improving the way we function in manufacturing. And agreeing with Lema, the debate on premature deindustrialization may not be the most relevant one. And by the way, we do have a paper mm-hmm. which is actually, contesting that finding. Anyway, so the floor is open. Raise your hand, please introduce yourself. Keep your question short so that we can take as many as possible. Yes, sir.
Thank you. I'm Dave Rabinowitz. About a century ago, John Maynard Keynes predicted that by now people would be working 15 hours a week, and they'd be working 15 hours a week because they would not be comfortable working less than that. Turns out, since that time, productivity increase has been even greater than he'd predicted. And I can tell you as a retired engineer that there are no jobs that are not susceptible to automation. We can talk in detail later. Now, if you look at the informal agricultural sector, averaged around the year, people are working less than 20 hours a week. Should Africa really accept the Western standard of 40-hour work week, or should Africa just take advantage of the fact that you're actually getting into this late and start with a 20 or 15-hour work week as the standard expectation?
Thank you very much. Next, please introduce yourself and just behind you. Please mention if you're directing your question to one member specifically.
Because the report is a collaborative effort, it's to anybody who wants to answer. Okay. But what I like in your report is that you're stressing the importance of innovation. Mm-hmm. Because what I recall IBM was told by the federal government, you have to share your code. It was part of the agreement with the government. Share your code. And then IBM became the platform for a lot of innovation. The problem you have is the problem that China is now facing with American industry today. Big corporations want to keep their code like Coca-Cola keeps their code in a vault. Can't do it. You will never get innovation that way. It's got to be shared. The university isn't enough. You've got to go train these unskilled workers in Africa. And you've got to rely on industry to supply those educators to train them. Now, that's how it's done. And you people who are in venture capital, it's important. I can't
emphasize how wonderful that there's a group of our bankers here, because that's where the problem lies. Until you say to our venture, to an offer to our innovator, you share your anything you get, you're willing to share. If it's commercialed, you share it, and even if it means that eventually you'll be out of business, and venture capital deals with that every day. But the problem lies with the banker. If we can get bankers to understand the nature of innovation, it requires a platform.
Okay. Thank you so much. I have a question here in front, please. And then you, sir.
L'André Signé, and I'm a fellow here at the Brookings Institution Africa Growth Initiative. Congratulations on an excellent report, as usual. I have a question, especially as I have a forthcoming book on Africa's role in the fourth industrial revolution, riding the world's biggest disruptive innovation. So can you be more specific about the opportunities that a leader planning for the next 10 years, 20 years, and developing specific program in order to offer the opportunities to the youth? What should they be doing? We know that by 2035, about 450 jobs will be needed, out of which 450 millions of jobs will be needed in the continent, amount which about 100 million could be anticipated of quality jobs. So what will you advise the leader to do to address the 300 million remaining one? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, the gentleman behind you, please.
Hi, thanks. Enjoyed the panel. My name is Lafcadio. I'm interested, because you are talking about investing in human capital, how you guys are accounting for brain drain if people wanted to leave immediately after. You know, you could make much more money in Silicon Valley or something like that. And then also, how do you take into account the concentration of wealth? I think you guys had mentioned Uber as an example. How can you make sure that it's African companies and technologies that are benefiting from this innovation?
Excellent. Should we take two more and then get a round of answers? Yes, here, please.
Hi. I wanted to ask about...
Can you introduce yourself, please?
My name is Emily Eisenhower. I wanted to ask about, so in the United States, the tech field has a reputation of being male-dominated, and thinking about windows of opportunity, I wanted to ask about, you know, what are you seeing in terms of gender disparities in the field in Africa, and what can be done to address that?
Excellent. And one last question, just behind there. Yes. Thank you.
Hello, this is Lashto. I'm a research fellow here at Brookings Institution. So I have a question about the role of competition policy in the telecom sector, because as you know, many of the digital economies are value-adding on top of technology services such as SMS and data and other voice and similar services. And so companies, the way telecom companies are structured, how competitive the telecom sector is, can define the outlook of the future of work, the way the digital economy is happens in practice. So if you take the case of Kenya, for example, Safaricom is known for pioneering M-Pesa, which is a famous mobile banking service. And Safaricom is often accused of being a monopoly firm and having a close tie with the government. So do you think that the telecom sector should be more competitive, or should it be more, should it work closely with the government to ensure that there's a more level playing field?
Great. So I got a number of questions here for our excellent panel. So should Africans work less? That's a big one. 20 hours per week. Well, should I ask Mary to handle this one?
Right. So obviously those 20 hours a week vary enormously from times of the year when it's 100 and times when it's very close to zero. So I'm sure the preference of smoothing it out would be there if that was even an option. I mean, some of it comes to standard of living, right? So I'm guessing our standard of living may still be higher than what Keynes thought it might have been when he said this a long time ago. I think it gets very... So I think some of it is an individual choice on how much people want to work than necessarily putting some kind of regulation as to what it might be. Different countries are debating this in different ways. Some of that's a political question. But I think a lot of it also is the standard of living that people are going to want to be able to have. But, I mean, one of the things that's also of interest, right, you think about the gig economy, is it actually gives an individual a fair amount of control over what kind of hours, when, and flexibility. You know, there's also some concerns to make sure people aren't getting abused in how what those would be. So there's, as always, trade-offs. So there is this possibility in a number of these digitally enabled work to give more flexibility to the worker and recognition that there may be also new risks that they're being exposed to. So I think there's going to need to be sort of continuous sort of looking at what some of those trade-offs would be too.
And I guess if I may add something, you know, it's all about productivity, right? You know, if we could raise productivity of agriculture in Africa, which has been stagnant for the past two decades, if we could raise productivity in agriculture by introducing more technology, more mechanization, more irrigation, for example, yeah, definitely the number of hours worked by our farmers would clearly decline. So it's certainly about, you know, raising productivity across the board for sure. Now, next question. Yeah?
I was just going to jump in there and say, I mean, I'd love to know where those 20 hours a week comes from. I mean, we did some studies a couple years ago where we looked at young people over a whole period of a whole year in rural Ghana, rural Uganda, and we had them count the number of hours they spent on different activities. And what we found was they did a lot of different things, and women especially did way more.
Oh, yeah.
You know, way more on the non-product, or what we would call like the reproductive activities, the family, the caregiving. I think it counts as work.
Yes.
Having a young toddler at home, I can tell you it's work.
That's true.
Should we?
Yeah.
Tris, should we? Can you build on that and address the gender divide question? Do you see that in the field, in your work with MasterCard?
So, absolutely. I mean, we, as Kuhl said in the introduction, we set a target of enabling 30 million young Africans to have dignified and fulfilling work by 2030. And, you know, 30 million is an awful lot of people, but it isn't nearly, it's like 10% of the estimated challenge by then. So we're just a drop in the bucket. And we said to ourselves that we wanted 70% of those to be young women. And then we take a deep gulp and we look out there and we talk to different partners and we say, how are we going to actually reach women? And not just in the tech sector, but, you know, across all sectors and all different opportunities. And unsurprisingly, this is really difficult. You know, and one of the things we are committed to is building the evidence for what's working, for whom, and under what conditions. So can we build more understanding of what the actual interventions are that are going to actually, you know, privilege women's opportunities? And it's incredibly difficult. I mean, I don't think we find many things that naturally or that people are just thinking of it on their own. It often requires an intentional focus on gender inclusion to bring that to the surface.
Great. Professor Lemon?
Yes.
Lemon, there's a question here on, you know, financing. Venture capital and bankers. Can bankers actually be expected to finance innovation? I'm not sure it's work anywhere. Venture capital... you know, how will Africa finance this digital revolution? Professor Sembet.
Okay. Let me begin by saying that there's already homegrown innovation taking place in Africa. And it's actually showing mostly in the form of fintechs. And I was actually preparing once a report for the World Bank, and I was kind of mapping what the heck is going on. And in a matter of 2 years, you have hundreds of fintechs, and they have actually begun attracting money, not just from the donors. I started seeing that they're actually getting money from Silicon Valley. So the issue is not that these guys are not innovating. The issue is really having, enabling, enhanced environment for them to innovate and scale more. So it's happening in Nigeria, in Kenya, and also South Africa. Again, in terms of innovation, innovation doesn't depend on the institutional design of a financial institution or a bank. Innovation could occur anywhere. Very similar to the argument that we make about sectors, right? So now, the big issue that we're facing in Africa is the scale. Very thin markets. Yeah. And disparate, fragmented. And I'm hoping that this big show that took place in Rwanda, you know, with AFCFTA, will actually help change that. So the answer for your question is that, yeah, as long as there are opportunities and incentives, innovation, financial innovation can occur in a number of ways, and it's actually happening, but it's not moving as fast. I think in that context, somebody asked a question about Safaricom.
Yeah.
And competition policies.
Yes. Can you handle that as well?
This is also one thing that we have to be careful about, because there is now growing digital financial services. Mm-hmm. So one issue that we're facing is, how do you regulate digital financial services? And typically, there are until multiple jurisdictions. So it takes like mobile bank. So you have a telephone company, and then there's also a banking service, right? So the question is, should it be regulated by a banker, a banking regulator, or a telecom regulator? So I was sitting on this Global Financial Inclusion Task Force in Washington. We debated on this, and we decided that was the wrong question. It turns out that you have to do that by functions. Okay? If somebody is providing a banking service, I don't care where they are, they should be regulated as the providers of banking. So now this Kenya is one of those countries which is actually getting ahead in this environment. I'm not sure that Safaricom is captured by the government. I just don't believe that.
Yeah. Okay. Excellent.
Yep.
Jin, mm-hmm. You've heard all this interesting yep. discussion and questions. Yep. You know, as a co-author of the report, what do you have to say on behalf of the team as closing? What are the key messages you believe people should go home with?
Okay. Yeah.
And that's going to be, you know, the closing of our panel. Yes. Go ahead, please.
I think our report can be summarized in one sentence. Future of work in Africa could be bright if government move quickly. That's it from me.
Excellent. That's extremely brief and sharp. Thank you so much. And I would like you to acknowledge this wonderful panel for me, please.